We have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to have you both back. And real quick, I just want to give a really big thank you to everybody that gave during our last pledge drive, last membership drive. It was great.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. We made the goal, and I greatly appreciate those of you that gave.
And as a consequence, we're back on the air this week.
We are. They renewed our contract at least through the end of the year. So, good.
Yeah.
All right, let's jump into the news because we have a limited amount of time, as we do every week, but even less this week. Let's start out local. The autopsy report on John Williams came out this week?
Yeah, the autopsy report on John Williams, the Native American woodcarver who was shot by police a couple of weeks ago. It turns out he was shot in the side 4 times by Officer Burke. He was not facing the man who killed him. Which puts a lie to the claim, the original claim by Officer Burke and the police department that Williams was threatening Burke. He was lunging at Burke with his 3-inch carving knife that he uses for wood carving. What they also found on his body was pretty interesting too. They found a radio and a pair of headphones with Williams' body, which also corroborates what some witnesses and his family were saying, is that he was deaf in one ear, and in addition he couldn't hear Officer Burke telling him to put the knife down because he had his headphones on and was listening to music while he was walking. So this is yet again points to the issue of the training that police get in this city, and also the fact that Williams is often described in the media as a homeless man when in fact he was in transitional housing, and of course he didn't look middle class or upper middle class, and so walking downtown when you're poor can sometimes be viewed as a crime by certain members of the Seattle Police Department.
The other thing that's going to be very interesting with the results of the autopsy is that the inquest system in King County requires an inquest hearing be held anytime lethal force is used by law enforcement personnel. Those shootings have 100% for something like 150, 160 of them been found justified since the imposition of that system some 30 years ago. It's going to be very, very interesting to see whether this scene is justifiable use of force by the officer involved, given that Williams was not faced toward the officer and pretty clearly didn't hear the commands to begin with and posed no threat to the officer.
All right. Anything else on that?
Yeah, he was carrying a 3-inch folding knife, and a lot of people think, well, you know, he had a knife out, so clearly he was a threat. But a 3-inch carving knife is legal in the city of Seattle. There's nothing in the city ordinance that prevents people from having that, and it wasn't a concealed weapon at the time. He had a piece of wood in his hand that witnesses said he was working on with the knife, so it was very clear to them that he was no threat.
All right. Well, if you've been watching TV at all, you're being inundated with numerous commercials for the election that's coming up, and a lot of 1098 commercials
yes.
pointing out that it's 1098 is bad for business.
Yes.
Scary, scary, be very afraid.
Lots of commercials on various issues coming up in the election and various candidates. But one that got under my skin was the one where businesses came out and said, oh, 1098, the tax on rich people in the state of Washington is going to be bad for business. Now, the 1098, just as a reminder to folks, would impose a state income tax. It's described in the ballot initiative as an excise tax, but it would be an income tax on single people who make more than $200,000 and married people who make more than $400,000. And so it's often described as the tax on rich people. And
it's important to mention also that that accompanying it is a reduction in taxes for a lot of other people.
Yes, it would reduce the state portion of people's property taxes by 20%, and it would increase the exemption for the B&O tax for small businesses. So an additional 118,000 small businesses in the state of Washington would be exempt from paying B&O tax, and another larger number of businesses would see a partial benefit from that increase in the exemption for B&O tax for small businesses. So what you have is mostly tech companies and large companies and their executives who are complaining about having to pay an income tax in the state of Washington. And what's interesting is that, of course, no business would be subject to paying the income tax. It's these flow-through corporations and partnerships whose shareholders and partners would have to pay the tax that are complaining. So in other words, it's these executives who make a lot of money who are saying, oh, this would be bad for business because it means I wouldn't be able to put as much money back into the business. And that's a load of bull. Really, the way that that these businesses would actually what the tax would do is it would encourage these flow through corporations and partnerships to keep some of the money that they would pay in dividends and use it to invest in the business. It would actually have the opposite effect of what these people are talking about. In addition, these guys have been saying, well, you know, we give our employees stock options. And stock options in the year that you're awarded them, they're not cash, but you often have to declare them as part of your income and pay tax on them, federal tax on them. And businesses are arguing, well, if the state imposes this income tax, then people will have to pay state tax on their stock options, and that will hurt my business because I offer stock options. Well, part of the problem with that is that stock options are usually most often offered to executives who make a lot of cash, who are paid a lot in cash dividends and have a high salary anyway, and they can afford to pay the tax. But in addition, a lot of companies also, as part of a compensation agreement, will offer their employees this option to pay the tax for them on their stock options in the year that they're rewarded as part of their compensation, so the employee really sees no hit to their income. And also, I just want to point out that both California, which where Silicon Valley is, and Massachusetts, where the big tech corridor in Boston is, have very large and thriving tech communities, companies that pay their employees in stock options as well as cash compensation. And those are two states that have some of the steeper income taxes in the nation. So that argument really doesn't hold true if you look at other parts of the country. In addition, nowadays, stock options are not as an attractive part of compensation as they were in the 90s when they were first introduced for a lot of reasons. First of all, stocks aren't doing as well in a stagnant economy as they were a few years ago. Many people nowadays need cash to pay their debts. They're not as interested in taking a job where they would be rewarded stock options instead of a cash salary. And in addition, a lot of people have learned that you don't want to have all or most of your savings and investments in the stock of a company where you also are paid your main source of income, your salary. Just ask anyone who worked for Enron what happened to their savings and investments when the company went under. Not only were they out of a job, they lost everything they had. So stock options are not as attractive for compensation as they were, and I would bet that a lot of companies are not offering them in the same way that they were offering them 10 years ago.
All right. Moving on to national and a couple studies out this week, one with dealing with election spending.
Yeah, speaking of all those TV ads that people have been seeing, the Center for Public Integrity has a study out in the wake of Citizens United, the U.S. Supreme Court decision early this year that basically opened the floodgates in terms of independent expenditures into federal campaigns. $500 million going this year into congressional campaigns. That shatters any previous records for soft money. 60% of that money going to Republicans, which is remarkable given that Republicans don't control either the White House or either House of Congress. But it tells you, number one, that many of these independent expenditure groups think the Republicans have a chance to control one or both houses of Congress after November, and secondly, that where their ideological sympathies lie. It also tells you a couple of other things. One is that, you know, given that these expenditures tend to skew conservative, they will only get worse if Republicans do have control of one or both houses of Congress or the White House, and the influence peddling gets even more pronounced. And secondly, it means having any kind of institutional reform, which would have to be passed by Congress in order to change Citizens United, one of the two major parties has a major financial incentive to block any kind of a reform that would close this loophole. So this may be the reality that we have to live with for a while, and we're certainly seeing seeing these kind of expenditures, both in the Rossi-Murray race, where unions are pouring a fair amount of money into Murray's campaign, and all kinds of business organizations in Wall Street are that have no real ties to Washington State are supporting Dino Rossi. And we're also seeing it in the 8th and 3rd District races, which are fairly competitive, the 8th District with Dave Reichert, and the 3rd District being the open seat to replace Brian Baird in Southwest Washington. This is the new reality, and we're going to keep seeing it for a while now, and people just need to put their BS filters on when seeing a lot of these ads. Yep.
All right. And second study at Columbia University?
Yeah, a study on the U.S. mortality of 45 to 65-year-olds that has been steadily increasing over the past 30 years in comparison to other industrialized countries, even allowing for obesity, smoking, car accidents, murder, and some of the other things that kill people before they reach old age. What is the difference between all of these countries when they have relatively similar rates of all those types of death? The one major difference and the factor that the Columbia University researchers pin this on is that only in the U.S. Is there a lack of preventative care because of the nature of how we pay for health care, that a large segment of our population simply cannot afford the same type and quality of health care as people in other countries receive. It once again underscores the cost both in lives and in cost of the economy of our relying on our for-profit health care system.
Yeah, and this comes in a week, too, when the Obama administration has issued waivers to McDonald's Corporation and a number of large health insurance companies who offer mini health plans. For folks who don't know what mini health plans
are,
it's
sort of like mini donuts. There's not really anything nutritious in them.
It's sort of like a McHealth plan, you know. It's for example, you can have a mini health care plan that provides you $2,000 of coverage if you have an accident or a health care emergency. $2,000 pays for nothing these days in the U.S. healthcare system. Literally pays for nothing. Part of it might pay for your trip in the ambulance to the hospital. The other part might pay for the first couple of lab tests, and then you're done. You're stuck with a bill of tens of thousands of dollars once you leave the emergency room. And really, these mini health plans are turning out to be a major part of the problem of what's wrong with our healthcare system. Because what happens is when someone has a healthcare emergency and, you know, they use up their benefits in a blink of an eye and are left with a huge debt that they can't pay, hospitals end up passing on that cost. Doctors and hospitals pass on that cost to their other patients who are covered by health insurance. And so our premiums keep going up and up and up, and fewer people can afford them. So the fact that the Obama administration is saying, oh, no, we don't want McDonald's to stop offering, you know, health insurance to its employees. They're not offering health insurance to their employees.
First, they would have to start.
What they're offering is offering an illusion. So the Obama administration is saying, oh, we don't want them to continue to offer this illusion of coverage to their employees. So let's give them a waiver. I think that's crazy. I think we should let these mini health care plans die. Some employees are actually having money withheld from their paycheck to pay a portion of their premium for these plans that don't cover anything. That's a crime. And those kinds of plans should be done away with and as soon as possible. But, you know, we're not seeing that.
All right. And, jumping to California, Mr. Schwarzenegger apparently inhaled.
Yes, exactly. He took a deep breath last week and signed into law an order that basically reduced marijuana possession in the state of California to a ticket infraction, that ahead of an initiative that's on next month's ballot in the state of California that would decriminalize marijuana possession entirely. But even if that measure is currently slightly ahead in the polls, but even if it does not pass, marijuana possession in California, now roughly on a par with a speeding ticket or a parking infraction or something like that. It's not a criminal infraction anymore. You're not going to go to jail for it and so forth, which is, you know, hopefully something, as with many other things in California, that the rest of the nation will follow the lead.
We'll become a model for the rest of the nation.
Yes.
All right. Let's move on then to this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week's economic news. I want to talk a little bit about corporate debt. We hear a lot about personal debt, you know, the amount of money people owe on their mortgages, plus their credit cards, plus their auto loans, et cetera, et cetera. We don't hear a whole lot about corporate debt. Well, it turns out that right now, not 2 years ago, not 3 years ago, but right now we're seeing record borrowing on the bond markets by major corporations. Now, a corporation or a large company can issue bonds to sell to investors, and that's how they, that's one of the main ways they can raise money. That's a debt issue for them. So that means they're borrowing money on the bond market. U.S. companies have borrowed $488 billion so far this year. That's 7% more than they borrowed all of last year. And what are they doing with that cash? Well, that's a good question. One of the main reasons that the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury have been pushing an environment of extremely low interest rates and have kept interest rates at near zero for so long is because they're trying to get corporations to borrow on the bond markets and then turn that cash around and hire more people to create jobs or to buy more equipment to create jobs in equipment manufacturers and so forth. It's an effort to try to stimulate the economy. But what are corporations doing with their cash? They're not doing any of those things. They're sitting on the pile of cash waiting for the economy to turn around so that they can invest it in a growing economy. They're restructuring their debt. They're paying off their short-term high interest rate debt by issuing longer-term bonds with extremely low interest rates. Some of the maturities on these longer-term bonds are amazing. They're 100-year on some of them, which means that some of this corporate debt won't be paid off until the next century.
Or they're buying distressed competitors.
Yeah, or they're using that money for mergers and acquisitions, which often, very often, if not nearly always, doesn't create jobs. It actually puts more people out of work, and that's not doing anything to stimulate the economy. It really reveals a major flaw in the U.S. Treasury and the Fed's policy of keeping interest rates extremely low to try to stimulate the economy. I also want to talk a minute about the junk bond market. Not only are corporations issuing bonds and borrowing on the debt market at record levels, companies with poor credit ratings are doing the same thing. So you may think of it like you think of home mortgages, for example, people with prime loans, which means they have good credit and can get a fairly low interest rate, versus people who take out adjustable rate mortgages and are riskier. Their credit risk. They have to take out a mortgage with a higher interest rate. Companies who are not in such great financial shape, companies that are a credit risk, they can borrow on the bond markets as well, but they have to issue what are called junk bonds with a higher interest rate attached to them. Right now, there's a big investor appetite for bonds that pay more than 1 or 2 or 3% interest. People are looking for bonds that have a higher rate of return. Junk bonds average about a 7.5% interest rate, and so those are very attractive for investors right now who are looking for some kind of return on their money, which they can't seem to find anywhere else. And so for the January through September period of this year, so the first 9 months of this year, $275 billion in junk bonds were issued. That's more than half of the total borrowing on the bond market is in junk bonds. That's a 69% increase over the same period last year. It's just an incredible boom. But, you know, junk is junk, and we could see problems in the junk bond market just like we saw problems in the mortgage market. And those bonds that pay a great rate of interest right now are fine for right now, but you have to ask, will people ever get their principal back buying junk bonds at this point, particularly if the downturn continues and those companies begin to go under? Also, in economic news this week, I want to talk a little bit about the flash crash on May 6th. When I mentioned this to Jav and Mike, they both looked at me and kind of puzzled. And they go, what's a flash crash? Folks may remember on May 6th when the stock markets went completely haywire for a short period of time in the middle of the day, about 2:30 to 3 p.m. in the afternoon on May 6th. the stock market went crazy. Stocks on the S&P 500 were trading, some for as high as more than $1,000 per share, some for as low as just pennies on the share. IBM, I think, was one of those stocks that fell below a dollar. Folks were just panicked. Oh, my God, what's happening to my investments? What's happening to these stocks? Some people jumped in with a woohoo and bought those shares very cheaply, and then had the folks who ran the markets turn around and cancel their trade, saying, I'm sorry, that was a mistake. What actually happened on that day? Well, a report was just issued by regulators who were tasked with trying to find out what happened, and they have announced the official triggering event, not the actual cause, but the official triggering event was an automated sale of futures contracts by Waddell and Reed, of course, derivatives. A derivative that was based on, it was a futures contract tied to the S&P 500. They started a computer program at 2:32 in the afternoon on May 6th to sell $4.1 billion of futures contracts. They programmed the algorithm, the sale algorithm, to sell those contracts regardless of what the price was and regardless of what else was happening in the market, so that computer program was programmed to sell no matter what happened. No, there was nothing in there to trigger a stop on the sale. So usually a sale like that would take several hours, take most of the day, but it actually the program dumped 75,000 contracts in a matter of 20 minutes. What happened is it was aggravated by high-frequency traders who jumped in to buy and sell securities in just a matter of seconds. High-frequency traders make their money by buying and selling a stock in a matter of seconds or fractions of seconds, and then using the pennies in difference in order to make an enormous profit by selling millions of shares throughout the day. These contracts, it turns out, changed hands 27,000 times in 14 seconds when only 200 contracts were actually bought or sold in that time. And that just aggravated the drop in price. And it turned out that as traders rushed in to buy these cheap futures, they saw, oh, my God, this is a great deal. These futures have dropped spectacularly in price. We're going to buy. In order to do that, they sold real stocks on the stock market, and that drove the price up and down for a lot of the shares on the S&P 500. So that is what people figure is the actual cause of the flash crash. What it turns out is that it seems that even though the markets have put in place circuit breakers to try to prevent that in the future, there's really nothing to prevent another company from doing what Waddell and Reed did on May 6th, and nothing to prevent high-frequency traders from causing the same kind of problems.
All right, that just bolstered my confidence in the system.
You realize what you just outlined is that our economic system is certifiably insane.
It is.
All right. We're running tight on time, so let's jump to international and Afghanistan. Congressional report.
Yeah, there was a congressional report this week that U.S. military bases in Afghanistan, which are supposed to be guarded by private security contractors, are often being guarded by Afghanis who are also members of the Taliban. How did this happen? Well, the U.S. military has decided that, well, we don't want our own troops to guard the bases because that would be too expensive for the taxpayer. We'll pay private contractors to do that, which often tends to be more expensive for the U.S. taxpayer. But, hey, that's part of the whole drive to privatize government. U.S. private contracting companies have turned around and decided, well, we will pay the cheapest guys we can find close at hand in Afghanistan, and they're hiring people in Afghanistan with military experience, which means, well, at least 50% of the guys you're going to get to apply for a job like that are going to be guys who have experience fighting for the Taliban. And it turns out that, yes, that is the case. That's caused a mini scandal in D.C. this week where you have senators and other congressional representatives saying, oh, my God, we're paying the guys we're fighting in Afghanistan. Well, hello, it's time they realize that, yes, that's what we're doing. We're paying both sides in Afghanistan.
All right. Didn't have time for it last week, a Department of Justice lawsuit?
Well, no, the Department of Justice responding to a lawsuit. Anwar Akwali is a U.S. citizen living in Yemen who has allied himself with jihadists there and has been targeted for assassination by the Obama administration for the last year or so. A lawsuit against the U.S. government by his father arguing that because Akwali has not been tried by any court, the U.S. government doesn't have the right to order the assassination of the U.S. citizen without any kind of due process whatsoever. You'd think he has a fairly good case about that. Well, no, the Department of Justice has come back and argued, is seeking to dismiss the lawsuit, not only on the merits, but arguing that the lawsuit can't even be heard because it would be an impingement on state secrets by the United States. So what you have for the Obama administration is taking even one step further than the Bush administration in terms of potential abuse of powers. They're now arguing that not only do they have a right to execute any United States citizen without due process, but that they can do so in secret, that to have any kind of a public discussion of that kind of a case would be an impingement on national security, meaning, Mike, for instance, that they could decide to assassinate you, and it would be a state secret, and not only would you and the people around you have no recourse, but it couldn't be discussed either. It's a really very, very alarming argument by the Department of Justice, and underscores just how bad the Obama administration has been on civil liberties and how the precedent that was set under the Bush administration is being steadily eroded and will continue to be eroded by administrations of both parties in the future unless there's any kind of public outcry around
and
it.
And a conservative court system.
And a very conservative court system, yes.
All right. And then finally, briefly, Brazil.
Brazil had a presidential election this week, and what was particularly notable about it wasn't who won or even who finished second and will get to participate in the runoff. It was who finished third. It was Marina Silva of the Green Party with 19% of the vote. This even though it's a relatively liberal president in Lula who is running Brazil for the last several years. It really underscores how in Latin America the political spectrum and the political dynamic is completely divorced from the options that people have available to it in the United States. It probably just goes to show that Brazil really, really needs an equivalent of Fox News, because you know something like that could never happen here.
All right. Events.
A lot of events going on, as is usual for October. Today, as you may have heard, at 7:30, it's the 9th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan. There will be a rally at 1 o'clock and a march at 2 o'clock, starting at Westlake Plaza, 4th and Pine downtown. Also at 1 o'clock this afternoon, a walk for a Free Palestine, a fundraiser for Palestinians, taking place starting at Pike Place Market. Tomorrow, 10-10-10, an organization called 350.org is having work parties around climate change happening all over the world and all over the Puget Sound area. Go to 350.org to find the work party near you. There are literally dozens in the Seattle area. On Monday, Federal Columbus Day, and there will be a federal protest because, quite frankly, Columbus was a genocidal maniac who... It killed a lot of slaves. That will be from noon to 4 o'clock at Westlake Park, again, downtown. And then a week from today, Saturday morning, the 16th, and we're mentioning it here because it's you know, starts about the time the program will be over. Margo Adair, who we mentioned last month, the political and spiritual activist in Seattle who is really known nationally, there will be a memorial service for her. That'll be at 10 o'clock, actually 9:45 at University Friends Meeting in the U District, and more information on Margo and on that event and on her life is on the Eat the State website at eatthestate.org. And for that matter, we now have calendar events at the front page, on the front page for coming days. You can check that out also at eatthestate.org.
Talking as we do every week, with Ja Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State, and you just told us where we can find Eat the State.
Yes. We should mention also, by the way, that then we'll start doing this on the air in the next week or two also, that our print election issue is going to be coming out next week with endorsements for the November 2nd election. People will be getting their ballots in the next week or so as well, so I'll look forward to that as well.
And you're looking for some distributors for that, right?
Absolutely, because we are, because our distribution network, now that we only publish every couple months or so, is not what it once was. So if you've been interested in helping us get papers around town, please email us at info@eatthestate.org.